Reading from Hebrews 11, 1 to 12, 3, and this is an abridged version. Now faith is confidence in what we hope for and assurance about what we do not see. By faith we understand that the universe was formed at God's command, something out of nothing. By faith Abel brought God a better offering than Cain did. Enoch was taken up, and Noah, when warned about things not seen, built an ark to save his family. By faith, Abraham, when called to go, obeyed and went, even though he did not know where he was going. All these people were still living by faith when they died. They did not receive the things promised. They only saw them and welcomed them from a distance, longing for a better heavenly country. By faith, Abraham, when God tested him, was ready to offer Isaac as a sacrifice. By faith, Isaac blessed his children, Jacob and Esau, and Jacob went on to bless his children. One of them was Joseph, who by faith spoke about the exodus of the Israelites from Egypt. By faith, Moses' parents hid him for 3 months after he was born, because they saw he was no ordinary child, and they were not afraid of the king's edict. This Moses went on to show great faith for his people, leading them through the Red Sea to victory over Jericho and more. It was at Jericho that the foreigner Rahab acted by faith to help the Israelites. All this is not to mention Gideon, David, Samuel, and many others who through faith conquered kingdoms, administered justice, shut the mouths of lions, quenched the fury of the flames, and escaped the edge of the sword. Women received back their dead, raised to life again. Some faced jeers and flogging and even chains and imprisonment. They were put to death by stoning. They were sawn in two. They were killed by the sword. They went about in sheepskins and goatskins, destitute, persecuted and ill-treated. The world was not worthy of them. They wandered in deserts and mountains, living in caves and in holes in the ground. These were all commended for their faith, yet none of them received what had been promised, since God had planned something better for us, so that only together with us would they be made perfect. Therefore, since we are surrounded by such a great cloud of witnesses, let us throw off everything that hinders and the sin that so easily entangles. Let us run with perseverance the race marked out for us, fixing our eyes on Jesus, the pioneer and perfecter of faith. For the joy that was set before him, he endured the cross, scorning its shame, and sat down at the right hand of the throne of God. Consider him who endured such opposition for sinners, so that you will not grow weary and lose heart.
Thank you, Ray. So here we are, we're at this point celebrating 100 years from the point of armistice, the end of the First Great War. But in that 100 years thing, I want us to think about the last 100 days of the First Great War. The last 100 days. By chance, a couple of weeks ago, I had a rare night in and I was flicking through the TV. And there was this drama reconstruction documentary program that was focusing in on those last 100 days of a war and explaining how finally, after all those years and years and years of trench warfare stalemate, finally the Allies managed to push through, and in those last 100 days the war came to a conclusion, and was explaining how that came about. And there was lots of factors. One of the factors was technology. The Allies had developed new technology. Their artillery was much more accurate, and their planes with reconnaissance, and that gave them an edge and factors like that. Another factor that the program explained was the strategy, and the three key generals managed to work out where to punch through the famous German defenses and the Hindenburg line, where to attack that to then unfold that big line of defence to enable them to finally advance. But what struck me watching this program about the last 100 days is that while there was this new technology, whilst there was this strategy, at the ground level, things were basically still the same. The attacks involved the commander blowing his whistle and the men going up over the top straight into the line of the enemy machine gun fire. In other words, it was still utterly insane. And there was carnage and many casualties, though the Allies did push through. And I wonder, how did they do that? How did they summon the energy and the enthusiasm to go over the top and advance forward into the enemy fire those last few times? Well, I guess morale was an important factor. Morale for both sides had been worn away by attrition, but the Allies had the advantage that they had fresh supplies coming up and American troops joining them as well. We know that for any endeavour, morale is really important. And I think that's why in our reading this morning from Hebrews, the author talks about this cloud of great witnesses, because the author, in writing to the recipients, is wanting to boost their morale. And so talks about this cloud of witnesses. But there's a defining factor for those witnesses if we now turn to that passage in chapter 11 through into 12. A defining factor for all those witnesses was their faith. And the author, back in chapter 11, verse 1, gives us a quick-fire definition of faith. He writes, "Now, faith is the confidence in what we hope for and the assurance in what we do not yet see." For me, a kind of mathematic engineering mind, split that into a simple equation. Faith equals confidence plus assurance. Well, you look up in the dictionary, the word confidence means an inner knowing. A knowing that despite whatever uncertainty for the endeavour, it will be true and it will come to pass. Assurance means having that little voice constantly backing you up and whispering into your ear that although you might not see it yet, although you can't see it at the moment, that it will happen. It will take place sometime in the future. And the author stresses that. He says, though we do not yet see it, we can have confidence and hope. It will be okay at some point. And that is the kingdom dilemma that we have. Jesus, remember, when he started his ministry, he said, "The time has come. The kingdom is near." And yet, clearly, although many great things happened around Jesus and his followers and things have happened down the ages, clearly, we still do not see every person and every situation correctly lined up with the will of God. Clearly, we see loads of bad stuff around us. And so we have to wrestle as believers, as followers of Jesus, we have to wrestle with this tension of the now, the time has come, the kingdom is near, and the not yet. The kingdom is not yet fully realized. We have to wrestle with that all the time. But however bad it looks out there, and of course the first great war, people thought this would be the war to end the wars, but it wasn't. And within 21 years, of course, we're back to square one effectively and starting all over again. And we know at the end of the Second World War, whilst we have had relatively peace, it has not been free of conflict. In fact, the last century had more wars than all the rest of history put together. And we know now that whilst we basically enjoy peace, it's an uneasy peace, and there is terrorism and there's conflicts elsewhere in the world as we speak, that the world is in bad shape. And we see difficulty all around us. And yet, despite what we do see, and not seeing things aligned with God's kingdom, despite that, we have confidence and assurance that one day Jesus' kingdom will be fully realized, that things will change, that his kingdom will come and be fully established. And even before that day, things will start to change and we'll see kingdom effects dotted around. It might be here and there, but things can change for the better. That is our faith, that Jesus is coming with his victory, and we start seeing glimpses of it even today and now. We have that confidence and assurance in his ultimate victory for his kingdom. So chapter 11 lists out all these people who had faith. Now, defining factor for each and every one is that they had faith, but also notice that it was a faith that acts. It's a faith that does something. It's a faith that endures something. It's not just a head knowledge. It's not just a static thing, but actually it applies into practice. Each and every one did stuff and went through stuff. That's one of the reasons why those of you who know me will know that I'm so keen that when we talk about our faith and what we believe, we then talk about how we put it into practice. What actions are we going to take tomorrow because of the faith that we have worked out today? Faith applies. And this chapter gives this amazing gallery. It starts with Cain, one of the earliest people in the Bible story, and then works its way through many names from way back, and then it works through the history of Israel, and it kind of gathers pace as it goes. I kind of get the feeling that the author started slow and said, I'll include that name, and then thought, oh man, I've got to include all these other names, and sort of sped up as the person wrote the letter. And it kind of gets to this frenzy of, well, there was this person who did this, and this person who endured that, and that person, they suffered, they were killed, but they were still faithful. And then there was that person, and it goes on into this excited frenzy of people who suffered for their faith. And it's almost as if the author is imagining that there's all these people up on the balcony to cheer us on, because they have had faith and they endured, and now they want to cheer us on and say, come on, you can do it, because we did it. We believed and we applied our faith and we saw things through, so you can do that too. And they're calling down to us now, going, come on, hold on, keep your faith, apply your faith, go for it. And cheering us as a great cloud of witnesses. There's another scene in the Bible that does something similar. It's in the book right at the end, the book we call Revelation. And in chapter 6, there's this great vision that this chap is having. And in that vision, he sees that there's loads and loads of believers who suffered to the point of death, were executed for their faith. And they're now wanting to see that ultimate victory. They know it's coming, and it's in the vision, it doesn't quite say this, but it's almost as if they're looking at the timeline of history, and they're calling out to Jesus, how much longer, Lord? It can't be much longer now. Our death was not in vain, because your victory will come, but how much longer? It must be coming soon. Revelation chapter 6, verses 9 to 11. Check it out when you have time. But here's the thing, going back to Hebrews chapter 11. Here's the thing, all those people who had faith, all those people who applied their faith, in verse 39, it says, none of them received what had been promised. So whilst they were so faithful, none received what they were promised. What's that about? What's that saying? Well, the point is that all of those people, all people who lived and had faith before the time of Jesus, so in this timeline stretching back here, they were all before the time of Jesus, of God's anointed, of God's Messiah, the one that God would send to bring his kingdom. They all lived before that time. So their faith was valid. Their hope was valid. The assurances that they had were valid. But they did not physically live to see the day of God sending Jesus, his anointed. They were looking forward to that day. They were looking forward to that time. Remember, we've seen as we've unpacked this letter to the Hebrews that it's writing mainly to the people of a Jewish faith, but the point is that the Jewish faith is a faith that anticipates God sending Jesus, anticipates God sending his son. Looking forward, that's the trajectory that it is going. But our author wants to say, but now it is different. Because in the timeline, we have now reached and gone beyond that point where God sends Jesus. Jesus has come. So from that point on, we are now in a new era. Jesus was the one who brought God's kingdom to start that new era. Jesus was the one who did that once and for all sacrifice. Jesus was the one who paid that ultimate price for freedom for all. And so our author writes, so therefore, chapter 12, verse 1. Remember, we're going through this letter, picking out the therefores. Author makes an argument, and so therefore we now do something about it. So therefore, in this new era, now we have passed in the timeline of history, past this point, with this whole cloud of witnesses cheering us on from the balcony, how much more should we be confident? How much more should we be assured to advance ourselves, applying our faith and putting our beliefs into practice? How much more should we do that? Because whilst the others, they had to look forward to Jesus, and it was all a bit vague and fuzzy for them, but for now, it's definite. Jesus has come. We are living in that new era based on Jesus. So if they had faith, how much more should we be able to go forwards in confidence? But if we're to do that, if we're to charge forwards, don't we need to drop the stuff that would otherwise hold us back? Don't we need to let go of those things that would keep us tied down? Now, we've all seen war films or footage from World War I and or documentaries on the trenches, and we've all seen those moments where the commander blows his whistle and the troops scramble up ladders or climb over the top and charge forward, haven't we? We've seen those. And we know that if you're going to do that kind of charge, you're going to leave your baggage behind. You're going to leave your pack behind. You're going to go with kind of minimal stuff. You're going to take your weapon, of course. You're going to have some armor. You're certainly going to have your helmet. But you're going to leave other stuff behind so that you can get over the top and run as fast as you can unencumbered. Yeah, that's what, that's only logical and common sense. Be stripped down to the minimum. Well, that's what our author is saying in chapter 12, verses 1 to 3. Let us throw off all that entangles, all that weighs us down, the baggage, the false aspirations, the worldly stuff that we cling to, that would stop us, that would hinder us, would encumber us from charging forwards. You can't advance with that stuff. It's too much clobber. You can't carry it effectively. But instead, you leave that stuff behind and you charge forward, fixing your eyes on Jesus and his kingdom and what he wants to bring for us and the whole world. In other words, not seeing the circumstance around you, but lifting your head and your eyes spiritually to look to Jesus and his kingdom one day fully realized. But I know what you're thinking. You're thinking, but if I'm to charge forward out there, that's insane, because there will be enemy fire coming at me, trying to shoot me down. I'll be going like straight into the machine gun fire, as the soldiers did over 100 years ago. And I'd say, yes, but absolutely right. It will be straight into the fire of the enemy to charge forward and apply our faith and put it into practice in that way. But if you remember nothing else from this morning but this one thing that I'm about to say, well, so be it. Just remember this one thing. Remember that we are in the last 100 days. That's the time frame that we're in. The last 100 days. We are the ones pushing forward in the final assaults, in the last 100 days of a war, of a struggle, of a spiritual dynamic that's been playing out for like thousands and thousands and thousands of years. But now it's down to us in these last 100 days to make these final pushes, these final assaults, to go and break through and break up the enemy lines and to break through. Now, just in case any of you here have not quite understood what I'm saying, I'll be clear. When I say the last 100 days, please understand, I am talking symbolically. I'm not talking about a literal 100 set of 24 hours. I'm talking symbolically, okay? It's an era we call the last days. Of the kingdom not yet, but really close. But it's the time when we are called to go on the assault. That's why if you've kind of analyzed my messages and the stuff I say, and you kind of break it into two categories, is it defensive or is it attacking? That's why if you break it down and you look at the stats, you'll find that on the whole, what I'm talking about with us as a church is the language of attack. Because that is what I believe is our calling. That is the age in which we live, the last 100 days, those final assaults to break up enemy lines. Because I'm not talking about attack with guns or bombs or grenades or shells, all that stuff. I'm talking about spiritual attack, a spiritual struggle, a spiritual warfare. Our weapons is to love people with the love of Jesus, backed up with practical acts of kindness and grace. Our desire is for kingdom stuff, not to blow people to bits, but to see people healed, to see people restored, to see people discover forgiveness, to see lives put back together. This is the stuff of the kingdom. This is the kingdom life that we want to see all around the city as we advance out across it. And so our attack charges our kingdom initiatives, like food bank or the Cadet Centre, or going into Ely College with a chaplaincy, or as I've suggested we pray into in the next couple of years ahead, pioneering out into the new housing areas that are now physically being built, expanding our city, taking the love of Jesus to people where they are. Those are our attack charges, our initiatives. Now, in the world's eyes, that's insane. And you might say it's insane because there's so much enemy fire out there. And yes, I do worry about casualties, because there will be casualties. It's messy, it's yucky, it's horrible. Things will go wrong, and that will not be pleasant for any of us. But we go in the love of Jesus with a confidence and an assurance in the ultimate victory of Jesus. Because Jesus has already won it. That's what Easter Day is about. We are a people defined by Easter. So anything that we attempt to do, and no matter how hard it is or how yucky it gets, it's defined by the events of Easter. And that tells us that ultimately Jesus and his love will win out in victory. So let us go forward, charging out in faith with a whole cloud of witnesses of people who have been faithful before us, knowing that they're kind of cheering us on, saying, you can do it. The ultimate victory is in Jesus. We've kind of seen it now. Charge out and keep your eyes on him and go towards it. Let us pray. Lord, lead us to where you want to bring love. Lead us to where you want to bring peace, forgiveness, and restoring. Even in the darkest and the most difficult parts of the city, the lives that just seem so far away, may we go in, not with our own bravado, but your spirit leading. And may we go in confidence, knowing that many have gone before. They are witnesses to your grace. And they cheer us on. Amen. The musicians are going to lead us in... in a well-known hymn. But in that, we are going to use one of the most powerful attacking weapons that we have at our disposal, which is the power of prayer. And I've talked about advancing with spiritual weapons. And we can do no worse than to start with prayer for that advance. In August the 4th, 1918, King George V met to pray with members of Parliament and encouraged a national day of prayer concerning the war and how it was stuck in stalemate. That was August the 4th, 1918. He called the whole nation to pray. 100 days later, to the day, the armistice was signed and the war was over. So let us sing, and then I'll lead us in that, in praying.